It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Protests are taking place today in five Wisconsin communities in opposition to the construction of new high-tech data centers.
The protests are part of a wider effort reacting to plans to build these centers in local communities. And in some cases, protesters say they want to block the projects outright. But in others, they say they are calling for more information and transparency, as well as state guidelines.
We're checking in with two local critics of data center plans to see what's driving the protests. Christine Lejeune is a founding member of Great Lakes Neighbors United. She's an organizer for planned protest today against a data center proposal in Port Washington. Christine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
This protest timed ahead of a local city council meeting coming up this evening. What are you hoping to accomplish? What message are you hoping to send to the council?
Yes, so we are essentially hoping to send to the council the message that we expect to be heard finally. This data center plan has been ongoing for the past year. People have spoken out consistently at plan meetings and the common council meetings and various meetings. But unfortunately, the mayor and common council members continue to okay the plans and move ahead without any indication that they're actually listening to their constituents.
What are the concerns that you and other people who are going to be protesting today have about the proposal as it stands?
Yes. Yeah, so currently, one of our largest questions that we have and concerns about the proposal surrounds the tax incremental district. Last week, we did receive certification of a petition that we had circulated through the community that would require any future tax incremental districts to be go to a referendum, but also would potentially apply to this current tax incremental district. That is one of the main concerns. Of course, the financial situation, the developer agreement is another question that is outstanding. There seem to be a lot of loopholes there as well. Furthermore, we just received information that last week during the Plan Commission on November 20th, the mayor simply okayed construction to proceed without end for 24 hours a day, 5 days a week, including also 14 hours over the weekend. So we're very concerned not only about the financial aspects of this, also the now sudden increase in planned construction that is coming our way, as well as environmental concerns as well, being so close to Lake Michigan and, you know, water uses, chemical uses in these buildings, as well as other issues that come with such a large construction in this area. Almost 2,000 acres, is planned for two phases. Of course, just the phase one is planned for now, but it is a huge concern for the future and currently.
As I mentioned, Port Washington, one of a handful of protests today. There were also some yesterday against local data center projects. Are you connecting yourself with people in other communities who are raising concerns about data center plans?
Absolutely. Yes, we are. This issue has really gained a lot of traction recently in recent weeks and months. And so we are connecting statewide, also nationally. This issue has high visibility. I believe it will also be a very hot election issue as well. This also extends past political boundaries. It's incredibly bipartisan. So we have people from across the state, from all sorts of political spectrums that we've met with and are networking with and are coordinating with today on this day of action, but also for future actions, as well as looking at, you know, statewide initiatives and legislation that can be enacted to control what is going on.
Now, supporters of the project in Port Washington, including the mayor, have said, hey, in the long run, this is going to help bolster the city's tax base, get it in better shape financially. Residents won't have to pay new taxes related to the project. It'll be funded in part by that TIF district you mentioned. Do you see that, hey, if you can address some of these environmental and process concerns, that there could be an economic upside for the community?
Unfortunately, not. There have been a number of studies done as well that, you know, regarding this TID, you know, agreement. And unfortunately, Port Washington will really not benefit from this project for at least 18 to 20 years. 40% of the costs of the tax incremental district are interest payments to the company Vantage. And the city of Port Washington will have to pay a 7% fixed interest rate. And so, you know, there's no cap on the interest rate or, you know, nothing that allows that interest rate to float lower. So this is a huge concern for the city, you know, residents. Also, the fact that data centers, as they currently stand, their lifespan is rather short. So, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20 years currently, you know, so we're going to be surprised if we even see any sort of benefit from this.
Christine, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Christine Lejeune, founding member of Great Lakes Neighbors United, talking about protests in Port Washington. We're talking about pushback against data centers across the state with a handful of protests today, some yesterday in other communities. We turn now to northwestern Wisconsin, where Citizens Against the Data Center in Menominee organizer Jan O'Neill is hosting a protest against their city's proposed data center project. Jan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I understand one of your main concerns for your local data center proposal would be its impact on local water. Why is that?
Well, water is an issue. We're right on the Red Cedar River, and the Red Cedar has two electric dams, right, going through the outskirts, one in Menominee and one in just north of Menominee in the town of Red Cedar Township. So that's a concern. And we know that electricity does use water. And that's a big concern for me. We're worried about not only the electricity, but the use of water by the data center. And they're draining a lot of water out of the ground surface or the ground water table, and they're not replacing it necessarily. And they're talking about this particular one we have in Menominee, they're talking about having a cooling system, but that hasn't really been proven, that cooling system, so we're not sure. But anytime you have a cooling system of the water, you're using electricity. And I think people don't stop to think about that. So you're using electricity to run the data center, and then you're using more electricity and water to cool down the water that's expelled from the center.
Now, last time on the show that we talked about the Menominee Data Center plan, a plan in the works was put on hold back in September by the mayor for further review after community concerns were raised. What do you make of the city's handling of the data center project when it comes to getting input from citizens like you?
Well, they were very reticent about getting input from the citizens. In fact, we did not know about it, most citizens in Menominee, that this had taken place until August. And when that was announced, oh my word, I was thinking, what's this? And so we started investigating, and that's when the Citizens Against Menominee started to investigate and educate ourselves. And that's why we're concerned about protesting today, is just to show and make awareness of the citizens in Menominee and say, hey, listen, speak up, talk to your city council, get them informed. We really believe that the city council meant well, and of course they want to have money for taxes or the data center people were offering money for nonprofits and giving them money as the time goes on. And that sounds very glorious. But look at the money that's going to be spent on electricity, road maintenance, water. We'll have to increase that. That will increase the taxes. And we all know that these developments are going to go through a TIF district. And in that case, as your previous speaker said, we don't get any tax money for maybe, could be 7 years or so. So we want the city council to consider all those things. And so last night at the city council meeting, very positive about the meeting. I was there as a representative of the city, citizens of against the data center in Menominee. And they have elected to, they made a motion, passed it, and they're going to send this on to the plan commission again. Now, they cannot change the zoning on this particular one, but they are looking at setting up a new zoning area that says it'll be a zone for industrial. And that's what the data center is right now. It was passed saying it was a warehouse. Well, it's not a warehouse. A warehouse doesn't use many, many amounts of water and electricity. This is going to run 24/7. So I'm very proud of the city council that approved and send it back. And so they get more information. They take the time and they listen to other sources. And that's why we've connected with the other coalitions in the state of Wisconsin, so we can provide more information, alert them to what's going on and the downside of the data centers, as in Port Washington. We have a lot of agricultural land that is surrounding the existing 310 acres that they did buy already.
And we'll leave it there. Jan, thanks for joining us today. That's Jan O'Neill, organizer for Citizens Against the Data Center in Menominee. We also heard from Christine Lejeune, founding member of Great Lakes Neighbors United in Port Washington. We checked in with two protest organizers in local communities working against data centers. If this is an issue in your community, no matter how you feel about it, support or oppose a local data center or have questions, let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, when the Oneida Nation saw alarming literacy scores for its youth, the Oneida Reads campaign was set in motion.
We're ramping up still. More opportunities for kids to get that high dosage tutoring, more professional development for teachers and support staff, better partnership with our school district partners.
Efforts underway to close the reading gap. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Childhood literacy is a major issue in Wisconsin. Most recent test scores show only about half of Wisconsin public school third graders could read at grade level.
And those numbers are even more stark for students from the Oneida Nation. In 2022, only 5% of Native third graders in Brown County were reading at level.
So the tribe decided to take action. The result is Oneida Reads, an initiative that aims to get all Oneida third graders up to reading level. It's a big goal with a lot of community backing.
Ann McCotter is project and change lead for Oneida Reads. Jennifer Webster serves on the Tribal Council for Oneida Nation. And Mark Paulus is CEO of Nation Services for Oneida Nation, and I spoke with them last week. Jennifer, years ago, you saw information on poor reading scores, and it really caused you to pause. What jumped out to you that then ultimately led to the Oneida Reads program?
Well, this term, when I came on council, we were doing part of our transition. We stopped at the higher education office. And at that time, it was Jackie Smith who explained what their department does, what they do for the community. And then she also went into some data about our reading proficiency for our Native kids. And at that point, I realized, you know, we're a multi-million dollar half government, half community, half corporation. There's got to be something more we can do for our community. To find out that 95% of our children were struggling, it hurt. And I thought, There's got to be something. And then I ran into Ann McCotter 2 weeks later, and she said, you know what? There is something we can do. We're going to put together a program. And, you know, Jenny, we're looking for a community champion. Would you do that? And I was all in, just knowing that something needs to be done.
Something needs to be done. Mark, what makes that third grade reading proficiency such a significant benchmark?
Well, as we've reviewed, up until third grade, students are learning how to read. And then after third grade, students are reading to learn. So with education, of course, there's required reading no matter what your education track. So it's vitally important that our students are on track with their reading so that once they are reading to learn, that they are academically prepared for success.
And I want to go back to that 5% of Native students were not at the third grade reading level. Was this crisis deeper than pandemic-related reading setbacks?
It was, actually. That data was from the 21-22 school year, so it was post-pandemic. But the data that we've looked at also shows this has been going on. And it's not unique to Oneida kids. It is a problem in our local area in general, a problem in the state of Wisconsin and in the country. But we looked at the Native student data in that 21-22 school year, and the demographics for Oneida or Native kids was the lowest. And so that meant we had an even stronger call to action. So yes, the pandemic did impact third grade reading, but it was a problem before the pandemic.
And fast forward then to the Oneida Reads program. Can you give us a classroom example of how this program is helping to fill gaps in literacy?
Sure. It really does come down to lots of different actions. So there's lots of ways Oneida Reads is touching early literacy. One example I can provide is through the Oneida Youth Enrichment Services Program. And those are teachers that are embedded within our partner school districts. And we have 4 public school districts we work with that the Oneida Youth Enrichment Services Program works with. And one example would be in an elementary school where we have a full-time teacher through the YES program who's working in a school district and helping the Native kids in that school, kindergarten through third grade, on a daily basis, Monday through Friday, the whole school day, full-time teacher, doing reading interventions using something called structured literacy or the science of reading. And they do that because they got some training, professional development through Oneida Reads in partnership with CESA 7. Our facilitator, Sarkis Wentland, uses what's called Lexia Letters, and we had 8 staff members who went through and got that certification last year. So having that right skill set is really important when working with kids who are just learning to read.
And Mark, you know, these interventions during the school day, so important, but what does this program do for perhaps after-school literacy or the partnerships with family members?
So we do have a number of programs within the Oneida Nation that are youth serving. One of those departments is our recreation department. The recreation department provides services and programming that our students, or many of our students, attend after school. And one of those programs is tutoring and academic support. So through the various departments of the Oneida Nation, we're providing support wherever our students are visiting or participating in programming.
And how important is having that peer-to-peer tutoring available to students?
Yeah, we do tutoring in several ways, but the research has really shown that high intensive tutoring is what really makes a difference, high impact. So that just means the length of time and how frequent it is during the week, how often students are getting tutoring. And so we look for lots of ways to provide those opportunities. And it's during the school day in many ways. It's also before school, after school, and in the summer. We also have, through Oneida Reads, been advocating for a program called called the Wisconsin Reading Corps, and they've been able to bring that tutoring support, which is high dosage tutoring, to four schools that we work with specifically. And some of those schools are within the Green Bay Area Public School District, and one of the schools is in the Seymour Community School District. So tutoring happens in lots of different ways, but it's really important that we make sure kids get enough of that tutoring, and that it typically is a small group, maybe one to two kids, sometimes just one-on-one.
So that's the high dosage piece of it?
Correct. Yeah. It's about, you know, is it 20 to 30 minutes in a chunk, and three times a week is the best situation.
Jennifer, as Oneida Reads has been unfolding and ramping up with these programs, what has been the response like from community partners?
We are so blessed to have so many community partners, you know, from our teachers to our tutors and our recreation center, parents. You know, parents are our partners as well. You know, just we had our second annual summit last week, and we heard from one of the parents who had their child in one of the tutoring programs over the summer. And she said her daughter's reading everything, and her daughter is so happy. You know, we're going to town. She's reading the signs on the way to town, and just really have blossomed with her reading. And that's so good to hear. It's so good to hear that the parents are making time to read to their children, because that makes all the difference.
In terms of the science of reading, in late 2023, Governor Evers signed Act 20 to improve and to change literacy instruction across Wisconsin. And I'm wondering, how does this factor into Oneida Reads, or is this making an impact?
Definitely Act 20 is a big part of what Oneida Reads is doing. So Act 20 brought structured literacy, or the science of reading, into the public schools, truly as a mandate. And it really is making a difference. And we do believe that Oneida kids are going to be much more likely to learn to read by third grade if they're given that structured literacy instruction. So we partner with our school district partners to really advocate and encourage and help adopt everything that is part of Act 20. So really, it's helping us to make sure that as we partner with those school districts, we bring it up in terms of what Act 20 is about. It's about science of reading, structured literacy. It's about doing those assessments and understanding where kids are at, knowing that if they're in the bottom 25th percentile on the Ames Web assessment, that they then get a personal reading plan, helping parents to understand what that's about and how they can advocate at the school for their child. But in general, Act 20 has been a really good thing for Oneida Reads, and to ensure that more Oneida kids will become proficient readers by third grade.
We're talking about Oneida Reads, this tribal literacy initiative to help Oneida Nation students read at grade level by third grade. And we're joined there by Ann McCotter, project lead for Oneida Reads. Jennifer Webster is here, who serves on the Tribal Council for Oneida Nation, and Mark Paulus, CEO of Nation Services for Oneida Nation. Mark, how are you assessing the effectiveness of this initiative, and where do you look for the data, and how will you track it?
So the primary source for data is the Forward exam, which was mentioned. So we're continuing to monitor data as it comes forward through the Forward exam on an annual basis. We're also working through relationships with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction and our local school districts to gather as much information and data as we possibly can. The more data that we have, the better it'll help us to choose programming and set our direction so that we are achieving positive results with our students.
And you recently wrapped up the summit on reading. What were some key takeaways from gathering together to discuss Oneida Reads?
Really just a lot of gratitude for all the work that is going on. I think many of our participants left really impressed by how much effort has gone into Oneida Reads in our first year and how much is really just taking off now. So a lot of appreciation for the support of the collective impact partners that are involved with Oneida Reads. A lot of appreciation for just the amount that of work that's going on. So people that really appreciate and want to be part of the change. So I would say that was the biggest takeaway, is people appreciating the work and wanting to be part of it.
If other tribal communities, other public school districts want to start their own program, I wonder what are some of the broader applicable lessons from a project like Oneida Reads? And Jennifer, you first.
I think, you know, having come out of COVID, you know, so many communities are struggling with just the effects of COVID. And then, you know, students struggling as well. So I think, you know, working with our partners, kind of putting together this model of what we've done, you know, communities don't have to start from scratch. You know, certainly the schools are working and you know, bringing forth as much as they can as far as reading. But just being able to be a part of this, part of this movement, and with that Act 20, kind of bringing everything to the forefront again, and sharing that awareness of how important reading is to you children.
I think about this movement in terms of you being a mother, being a grandmother of Oneida Nation children, and wanting this literacy focus, not just for the children of today, but for future generations. Jennifer, do you think about that?
Yes. You know, when I was a young mom, when my children were young, you know, we're having supper in the car on the way to soccer, on the way to bowling, you know, reading just wasn't in the mix. Reading was right before bedtime. That 5 minutes before bedtime, that's where we spent our reading. And, you know, I kind of relied on the school system to take care of those educational needs for my child, not realizing how important that, how much that I have to be a part of that education as well. And then now that I'm a grandma, I've got a little bit more time, you know, to spend that time reading with the grandchildren. But just knowing that we need to push more time with parents and their reading as well.
Yes. Mark, what would your thoughts be if other communities want to start their own initiative?
Well, I think it starts with the data and understanding the data from as many perspectives as they can gather data. Number two is building awareness, both internally within their various departments and with those that they may be collaborating with, and then also building awareness with the community. And then finally, family engagement. So much of this revolves around the parents and the ability of the parents not only to be involved in reading with their children, but also being aware of the supportive services that exist in the community. Because, of course, the children, they're reliant on their parents for transportation and awareness. So really getting the parents on board is critical as well.
And Anne, you recently celebrated 1 year of Oneida Reads. I wonder, are there any lessons learned, or what are you looking ahead to in year two as the school year moves forward?
For sure. I think one of the biggest things that I would serve up as a tip to other communities would be to connect with an organization that we connected with, the Campaign for Grade Level Reading. They're a national organization. There's 350 communities that are all working to drive third grade reading like we are. So that really was helpful for us. And we officially became a partner community with the Campaign for Grade Level Reading in June. So that has been helpful. They guide us. They're the backbone organization that we work with. And in terms of what's next for Oneida Reads, we're not slowing down. We have a lot going on and we're ramping up still. More opportunities for kids to get that high dosage tutoring, more professional development for teachers and support staff, better partnership with our school district partners, for instance, with Green Bay Area Public, school district. We have their Title VI team, which are the individuals working directly with Native students on reading. They're joining our Oneida Reads cohort at CISA 7 doing training in that Lexia letters. So they're going to get a year of professional development in structured literacy along with our Oneida teammates. And just more partnership, I think, is a big part of what's coming next. And then the other big part of our focus going forward is more family engagement work to be able to make sure that families are part of the solution, that they understand their role in helping their kids become proficient readers by third grade.
I want a little more here on how Green Bay teachers are responding to this project. What have you heard?
Well, the good news is we had about 20 individuals from the Green Bay Area Public School District who were at our summit, all the way up to the assistant superintendent, David Johns. So that shows support. Out of 175 attendees at the summit, about 20 of them were from the Green Bay Area Public School District. We also have an action team that meets with the Green Bay Area Public School District quarterly. And we talk about the work of Oneida Reads and how we can partner together better. We've got great partnership from their early literacy team, the director and assistant director, down to the school building level. Matt Melkor is the principal at King Elementary. He presented at the summit based on the work they're doing with Wisconsin Reading Corps. So we have a really unique partnership with Green Bay Area Public, and that's something we work towards, and it's taken years to develop. But I'm glad to say they're a huge support in terms of all the things of Oneida Reads.
Well, Anne, Jennifer, and Mark, thank you so much for sharing about this program. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Kate.
Thanks for having us.
That is Anne McCotter, Project and Change Lead for Oneida Reads, Jennifer Webster, who serves on the Tribal Council for Oneida Nation, and Mark Paulus, CEO of Nation Services for Oneida Nation. We've been learning about Oneida Reads, a local literacy initiative that aims to bridge the reading gap for Oneida students. We found out about this project on my recent visit to Green Bay, where I met up with listeners like you at a coffee shop to hear some of the stories that are part of the fabric of the community, including Anne and her work with Oneida Reads.
We would love to hear your stories of local community impact and projects. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or look out for another Wisconsin Today event in your part of the state. Tell us, where should we go next? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Still to come, visit the workshop of a Wisconsin artist who makes unique book art that can change the way we think about books.
The reader really has to interact with the book in various ways. They're not just turning pages, but doing other actions in order to find the content.
That's coming up next.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In general, we know how books work, right? You open them, read them from left to right, top to bottom, page by page. But in a Wisconsin workshop, things are different, and physical books become pieces of art.
Works of book art often have movable structures, three-dimensional aspects, and a lot more than words, paper, and spine. And they tell stories in surprising ways.
Here in Wisconsin, Julie Chen is a world-renowned book artist and professor at UW-Madison and creator of Flying Fish Press. Over her 30-year career, she's created hundreds of pieces that have been shown around the globe. Producer Mackenzie Crummy and I joined Julie in her Madison studio for a close-up look at how book art is made. Julie, for people not familiar with that concept, they might think, okay, books, sure, they could be artistic, but book art, how do you explain that to people who are not familiar with it?
Okay, well, in order to explain book art, I have to first explain that there are two versions of that phrase. One is book art, and the other one is book arts that has an S at the end of the word art. And the difference is the book arts with an S refer to all the craft and technique that goes into making books. So that includes things such as letterpress printing, book binding, paper making, all of those things that would create the printed page or put the pages together into a book. Those are the book arts. That also would include printmaking and other types of media that people use in books. Book art is when an artist uses the book as a medium for creating a work of art. So it may seem like I'm splitting hairs a little bit, but the difference between book art without an S and book art with an S is kind of a big deal in the book art world.
What's striking me is it's a really unique experience. With a book that I'm going to read, I read left to right, top to bottom, then turn the page. If there is a sculpture, generally the sculpture is just sitting there. I can look at it from different angles maybe. A book art, though, it moves, right? There are moving pieces, and they have to move for me to understand it, like I'm turning the pages of a book. I'm kind of trying to wrap my head around this unique experience.
Right. So the other term that we use in book art is artist book. So we refer to sort of the field of artist books or people who make artist books or all the activity that goes into making an artist book as book art. But what we're actually making, the end result, the book, is called an artist book. And not all artist books are as interactive as mine are. Some people use the standard codex format, which is the type of book that you would, you know, go to the bookstore and buy a book and turn the pages and read that book. And they make really amazing books that way. For me, I'm often using non-traditional book structures that are kind of hard to explain on the radio, but but the reader really has to interact with the book in various ways. They're not just turning pages, but doing other actions in order to find the content. I'm going to put this aside. This is one of my most recent works. It's called A Monument to What Remains, and it's a really big box. And when you flip it open, it's actually two boxes side by side that are housed together. And then inside the boxes, there are six very skinny accordion books with very large type. The whole text on this side says, "This is a monument to the fragility of memory." And then if you keep flipping through the book, there's another phrase on the opposite side. And for this book, the phrase on this side says, "We honor those who were unthanked and unnamed." And the idea for this book came from my interest in public monuments, and especially in the last few years where a lot of Civil War monuments are being taken down. And it really got me thinking about who gets to decide what gets memorialized and what doesn't. I had a friend who had gone to Vietnam. He wasn't injured, but his life was really not the same. I'm standing at the Vietnam Memorial and I'm thinking, well, where's his monument? He served his country. He didn't die, so he doesn't get to be on the wall. But his life was affected for the remainder of his life. And so I started to really think about, if I was going to create a monument, what would it be? So a lot of the text, all of the phrases in these six books are things that wouldn't get memorialized. They're things from everyday life and little failures and little things that weren't, you know, you wouldn't get a trophy for, you wouldn't get a monument for. And so after you read all six books, so there's three more on this side, you can open them up, fan them out sort of like an accordion, a zigzag pattern. So you set these discs into all the slots, and then you can put all the books on top of each other and you can create a big wall. So it's a book that becomes a monument, and the reader has the ability to choose what order and what side of the book appears together. So it's sort of like they're making a physical monument, but they're also having some control over what the monument says.
What goes into creating the concept that leads to the creation of a piece of book art for you?
So in my work, it always starts out with something that I'm interested in. Maybe something I hear about in the news, or something that I hear about repeatedly in the news, you know, such as global warming, something that happens to me in my personal life, that's just a personal experience that I'm trying to work my way through. Whatever it is, it's a long process for me of thinking about what it is I'm trying to say. And then there is a research component where I try to find books about the topic that I think I'm interested in making a book about. Usually that leads to other topics, you know, one thing leads to another. And it turns out that what I'm trying to say might not be what I thought I wanted to say at first. So I do that research and I'm taking notes and I'm always thinking about what kind of experience I'm trying to give the reader ultimately. And that helps bring me back to what is it that I'm trying to say.
Now, one thing I'm curious about is, okay, if I do a sculpture, I've mm-hmm. made one sculpture, probably.
Yes.
If I get a book published, I'm going to, well, if it's me, probably 10 copies, but dozens, if I'm Stephen King, you know, yeah. millions of copies. I don't know. How many copies of a particular piece of book art might you make? Are each unique? Do you do a run of more than one? I don't know.
Yeah, so I make editions. I've always made editions since the very beginning. In the early days of Flying Fish Press, which is the name of my imprint, I would make 100 copies of a book. And as my books became more and more labor intensive to put together, that started to become less feasible because it would take me years to put together the whole editions because so much handwork goes into putting these complex structures together. So now I make about 30 copies, between 20 and 30 copies in my editions. And that still takes quite a long time to put those copies together.
Right, because most of the steps, as I look at the work, these are clearly not things you could automate easily. Maybe the printing, once you have the basic thing that you're mm-hmm. going to put on your letterpress, that's easy to make multiple copies
yes.
of. But I think that's the only part that's easy to reproduce quickly.
Yeah, that's the easiest part. Once you have the design that you're going to print, and in my case, I'm using the computer to do digital design that I then have plates made, mm-hmm. like physical relief plates made that I can then print on my printing press. Okay, so we're in my studio in Art Lofts at UW-Madison. I have a lot of tables where I work assembling my books, and I have a huge number of flat files because all of the book parts have to be housed somewhere. And so for all the editions, there are drawers and drawers that are full of parts of books that haven't been assembled yet. 20 drawers here, I've got, you know, 30 drawers here, I've got 10 drawers in the front of the room. So these are all like parts of books. So if you open up the drawer, you'll see partially processed parts that are going to go into the finished book. But I've got many, many drawers full of parts. And in addition to all of those things, I have my printing press, so I can turn that on. You can hear it. So it sounds like that. So let's say you have a photopolymer plate or wood type, it would be on the bed, and these rollers would have ink on them. Okay, so then this whole assembly rolls over here, so the type gets inked up, and then the paper that you would be printing would be wrapped around the cylinder, and so then this rolls forward, and the paper rolls over whatever is on the bed, and then with a switch, we roll it back.
Your press is Flying Fish Press.
Flying
Where
Fish
did the name come from?
Yeah, that's not a very interesting story, but I'll tell you the story. So when I was in graduate school, like I said, I didn't really know anything about fine press or about making editions, but everybody had a press name. So I had to pick a press name, and I'm trying to think, well, what are other people's press names? And a lot of press names are maybe named after different animals or plants or mythological creatures. And I thought, okay, I need to pick out something that will represent what I'm planning to do. And at that time, I didn't know what I was going to really be doing. So I chose the flying fish. And at the time, I have to really be honest and say there was just something very elegant and kind of interesting about the idea of a flying fish. And it wasn't until later that I kind of came up with a story that kind of went with that name, which is that the flying fish kind of really is successful because it spends a lot of time between the elements. It lives in the water, but it keeps itself safe by leaping out of the water into the air. And I kind of like that idea once I came up with this concept of what I was trying to do was sort of in between two worlds, and that I was going to sort of exist doing this work that wasn't traditional, but it wasn't also, you know, super experimental. It was kind of right in the margin between those two things.
It's an interesting medium, I guess. It's conceptual and kind of like brainy on the one hand, but it's very practical, right? You got to make sure your press is functioning.
Yes.
And you're, I assume, hand stitching your mm-hmm. binding and things like that. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the appeal to you, that it is this very thoughtful thing, but yet a very hands-on practical art at the same time?
Yes, definitely the craft part of it is really important to me. When I think about my own work, I'm always thinking about a physical object. There's no reason why I couldn't switch over and do digital work. I use the computer a lot in my design. So why not make videos? Why not make things that just exist, you know, on a screen? Well, I'm not a programmer, so I would have to learn how to do that. But the point I'm trying to make is that the physical object is a really important part of how I understand my work and how it exists in the world. And so the craft elements are a really important part of that.
Now, it can be a little tricky for people to interact with book art in the world. You mentioned the library at UW-Madison has things where the public can make appointments and come in. Can you make the case for people who are saying, yeah, this sounds super cool, to go out and check it out in hopefully a library not too far from them?
Yes, I would definitely encourage everyone to go to the Kohler Art Library here on the UW-Madison campus. And you can look up their artist book collection online. They have an artist book database that has photos as well as descriptions of the book, and you can type in keywords. So if you wanted to look at pop-up books, just type in pop-up book and it will give you a list of artist books that use pop-ups. And so that might be something that then you would see something in a photograph and say, oh, I really want to see that. The reason I would encourage everyone to go to a library to see artist books is it really isn't an interactive experience. You can't really just look at a book in an exhibition the way you might look at a painting or a sculpture. You have to interact with it, and you have to be able to read it page by page, or maybe whatever the structure causes you to do, that the content in a book is going to be revealed over time. So it's really a time-based medium that's more like film or theater than it is like other visual arts like sculpture and painting, which are not necessarily time-based. And so the only way to really experience a book, an artist book, is to go to a library or a collection and actually interact with that book.
Julie, thanks a lot for sharing your work with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Julie Chen is an internationally known book artist who's been publishing limited edition artist books under the Flying Fish Press imprint for over 30 years. She's a professor of book art at UW-Madison. We've got pictures from our visit. You can find them on the Wisconsin Public Radio Instagram feed. You can follow everything there, from breaking news to stories of people doing cool stuff around the state. And if there's somebody in your community making a difference who's up to something interesting or cool, send us a note at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
The Milwaukee County Zoo is set to open a rhino care center this month as they welcome two black rhinos from Cincinnati Zoo and the Racine Zoo They hope that one day Kianga and Zuri will mate and help give a boost to this critically endangered species.
And we want to know, what conservation efforts do you see going on at your local zoo? Do you like to visit a zoo in the wintertime to see what the animals are doing in the snowy season? Maybe your zoo has a holiday lights display. Tell us about your connection to a zoo and the traditions you have visiting it.
We hope to share your story in a future program. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that number is 888-642-0232.
And thanks for being part of the program.
Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.